KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump's sweeping tariffs became a reality at midnight. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are questioning his strategy. We'll hear from Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington State. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court has once again ruled in President Trump's favor. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. This time, the justices are allowing Trump's dismissal of 16,000 probationary federal employees to go forward, at least for now. Three children without legal status in the U.S. are due back in a rural New York school after protests and bipartisan lobbying. And British pop star Lola Young stops by our studios ahead of Coachella and talks about getting personal in her songwriting. It's Wednesday, April 9th. Happy birthday to Marc Jacobs. The fashion designer is 62 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump's latest set of tariffs has gone into effect on dozens of countries. This comes after the 10% tariffs took effect last weekend. U.S. tariffs on China have now soared more than 100%. China is retaliating. It has increased its tariffs on goods imported from the U.S. to 84%. Wall Street has started falling in today's trading after several days of losses. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says, unlike China, U.S. allies are prepared to negotiate new trade deals.
At a point in the not-too-distant future, I think we'll be back to firing on all cylinders. We have the response to the countries who want to come and sit at the table rather than escalate has been overwhelming. Our allies, Japan, South Korea, India.
He spoke to Fox News. But China is not alone. The European Union members have voted to retaliate with tariffs on billions of dollars of U.S. goods. The EU says it is prepared to impose a second round of tariffs if needed. The president's proposed tariffs on clothing and footwear imports could lead to significantly higher prices for American families. NPR's Windsor Johnson reports more than 95% of the clothes and shoes sold in the U.S. come from overseas, mainly Asia.
A commonly asked question is why companies don't simply move manufacturing back to the United States. The answer often comes down to the cost of labor. Manufacturing clothing and footwear is labor-intensive, and American workers are paid much more than their counterparts overseas. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average hourly wage for a U.S. apparel worker is between $17 and $20. That's compared to just $1 to $3 in countries like China, Vietnam, and Bangladesh. As a result, many brands rely on overseas factories to keep prices down. The Trump administration's proposed tariffs could upend that balance, forcing companies to either eat the cost or pass it on to consumers. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The acting commissioner of the IRS is stepping down. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the move comes after the agency agreed to share private taxpayer data with federal immigration officials.
Melanie Krause is the third IRS leader to quit the tax collection agency since President Trump took office. News of her departure comes shortly after the Treasury Department agreed to allow immigration officials to use some taxpayer data in their search for people who are in the country illegally. IRS data has traditionally been closely guarded, even from other government agencies. Critics say the new agreement likely violates data privacy laws and may discourage immigrants without legal status from filing tax returns. A Treasury spokesperson says the Trump administration is, quote, breaking down data silos, adding that sharing taxpayer information will help to identify waste and fraud and make for a safer country. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Flood warnings remain up in nearly a dozen states from Ohio to Texas. Storms that broke out last week swept across the central, midwestern, and southern U.S., killing at least 23 people. These triggered flash flooding. The National Weather Service now says nearly 30 rivers are at major flood stage. There are fears of more flooding in Kentucky, Indiana, and Tennessee. The State Department says it is aware of reports that Ukraine has captured two Chinese soldiers fighting for Russia. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the Trump administration has been trying to get Russia to agree to a ceasefire in Ukraine and is sounding increasingly frustrated.
State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce says it is disturbing to see Chinese citizens fighting on behalf of Russia in Ukraine.
China is a major enabler of Russia in the war in Ukraine. China provides nearly 80% of the dual-use items Russia needs to sustain the war. 80% comes from China.
She says the U.S. will know in a matter of weeks whether Russia is serious about peace. Bruce adds that a deadly Russian ballistic missile strike on President Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown further heightens, in her words, President Trump's urgent call for peace. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Associated Press is reporting fewer foreign travelers came to the U.S. in March. The AP cites federal government statistics that show visits to the U.S. from overseas dropped more than 11% last month. Air travel from Mexico dropped by nearly a quarter. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. As U.S. tariffs go into force today on European aluminum and steel, the European Union has just approved 25% retaliatory tariffs on a wide range of American products, including almonds, orange juice, poultry, and yachts. The EU also says it is preparing and poised to announce tariffs on a second list of U.S. products next week if the Trump administration does not negotiate. For more, we go to NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. So, Eleanor, tell us more about what the EU has decided.
Well, all 27 EU countries except for Hungary voted in favor of imposing these tariffs on U.S. products, though the volume of the U.S. imports affected by the EU tariffs is around 22 billion euros, a little bit less than the volume of the European aluminum and steel that's going to be affected by the U.S. tariffs. That's around 26 billion euros. No one in the EU wanted this. Here is President Emmanuel Macron speaking.
La France, l'Europe n'ont jamais souhaité le chaos.
He says France and Europe never wanted this chaos or the raising of tariffs. We think it's a bad idea and a bad response to the U.S.'s commercial deficit. But Macron said the EU will respond if it has to protect its industries. Now, the EU does have a huge market in its rich 450 million consumers. Of course, all of this is happening against the backdrop of these stock market gyrations and panic in Europe over that, and the prospect of this looming trade war and perhaps even a worldwide recession.
Now, President Trump has been talking about how many countries are lining up to negotiate. Will there be any room to negotiate with the EU?
Well, the EU has extended the deadline for this second wave of tariffs for that, and it's certainly hoping to negotiate. In fact, France, Ireland, and Italy secured the removal of bourbon from the list of targeted American products after President Trump threatened that its inclusion would trigger a 200% tariff on European alcohol, which is a huge export. For France in particular, the U.S. is its biggest market for wines and champagnes, and wine growers are extremely worried about a looming trade war.
Everyone might need a gulp of bourbon if this thing lasts long.
Yeah.
So how does Europe fit into the big picture of countries responding to U.S. tariffs with tariffs of their own?
Well, the EU is offering to negotiate. It's even offering zero tariffs if the U.S. reciprocates. But, of course, after much deliberation, it has set out a list and a schedule for tariffs. But, you know, let's notice that it has a timeline for increasing tariffs that goes into effect as far away as December. So that's more than half a year away. It's clearly a carrot and stick go slow approach, which contrasts with some of the more decisive and immediate moves by China and Canada, for example. You know, many analysts say the EU is trying to offer President Trump multiple opportunities to climb down or to strike a deal at some point, all while allowing the pressure of those other major American trading partners to take effect, which could perhaps make the job easier for Europe. You know, Europe is also dealing with the possibility of the U.S. abandoning its support for Ukraine, pulling back in NATO, maybe taking out some American troops in certain NATO countries, which means Europe needs to spend more on defense. It already knows that, but that's kind of hard to do if your economy is tanking because of a trade war. So EU leaders are really feeling the strain. They've got difficult choices ahead.
That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Thank you.
Thank you, A.
President Trump's escalating tariffs on trading partners around the globe has rattled U.S. and international markets. It's also set off alarm bells in Congress, where senators have introduced bipartisan legislation to rein in presidential powers on tariffs. I'm joined now by one of the authors of that legislation, Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington. Good morning.
Good morning, Layla.
Thank you for being here. So I want to start with the bill you drafted. What would it accomplish if it became law?
Well, Congress constitutionally has the right on trade, really, if you think about it, on interstate commerce and foreign commerce. But this president has misconstrued and we think actually misused this authority. So we're saying we want Congress to reassert itself in this debate and get approval for these unbelievable tariffs that are costing consumers so much money and ruining people's 401 savings.
This is described as a bipartisan bill. You co-authored it with Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican. But how much Republican support is there for this bill? I mean, can it pass?
Well, I think we have seven Republicans on the bill so far, which was just introduced last week. The House representatives introduced a bill with two Democrats and two Republicans. So it is continuing to be bipartisan, bicameral. And I think it's because people are hearing from their constituents who are saying, wait, why am I paying this extra tax on these consumer goods? I don't want to do it.
Now, the president has threatened to veto your bill if it ever comes to his desk for signature. And already a lot of people are saying it's really, really unlikely that it could pass, even if it passed the Senate, that it could pass the House. We're seeing the House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senate Majority Leader John Thune are still sticking with the White House. What would you do in that case if you get this bill passed and Trump vetoes it?
Well, Layla, I don't think people thought the economy was going to drop $11 trillion investment either. And so the point is that this is wreaking havoc on consumers, which are basically, GDP is about 70% consumer spending. So Congress has a right to say, what is the plan here? Why aren't you consulting with us as we have to consult with our constituents? And the thing that people don't want is to have continued uncertainty. A lot of people who are looking at their 401, maybe they were going to retire this year, have great concerns about what that means for them personally.
But what I'm asking is there a true path in both chambers to get this to become law?
Oh, for sure. This continues to be an economic nightmare for people. Yes, there will be a path.
And if Trump vetoes the bill, you would need to get 2/3 in both chambers, right, for it to pass? I mean, are there other paths? Are there other options?
Well, my colleague, Senator Wyden, is introducing another resolution related to this. So the good news is that our colleagues are waking up to the fact that the president went too far and that we need to have a discussion. We need to listen to our constituents. We need to listen to the small businesses. We need to listen to the consumer who's being hurt here and decide what it is that we can do to reassert ourselves in the debate.
Now, Trump says the tariffs are necessary short-term pain or medicine to deal with this long-term problem of the $1.2 trillion trade deficit. Do you agree with that?
I disagree. First of all, we need to continue to drive inflation down. A tariff is just like a tax that's going to make everything more expensive at the grocery store, at the appliance store. I think that if the president wanted to use a power, he should unite people collectively, like the Europeans or other Asian countries, and try to counter China that way through a coalition. And then they could force open markets or force more fair accommodations. But
that would be the approach you would support to closing the trade gap.
Oh, for sure. Yes. I represent one of the most trade-dependent states in the country. And so we're very proud that we make airplanes, that we grow a lot of agriculture products. So we want the United States to be a leader in the economy of tomorrow and all the job creation that is going to come with that. And we think that the way you get there, just like these companies have become big juggernaut companies in the Northwest, you get there by innovating, by having a great skilled workforce, and by having open markets to sell your product to. And that there are strategies to take the next step in that that would help the United States in an information age win more market share. And we should be doing that versus kind of taking our best trade allies and making them mad at a time when we really need them to be on our side.
That's Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We invited the Republican co-sponsor of the bill, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, to join us. He respectfully declined.
What could President Trump's tariffs mean for duty-free shopping, like the kind found at international airports?
So duty-free shopping basically is an exemption of import duties and taxes.
Scott Laird is a freelance travel writer. He's written about tariffs and duty-free shopping for voters.
Because the notion is that if you are immediately leaving the country and not using the products that you're buying in that country, that you shouldn't be subject to import duties or local taxes when you purchase those items.
Laird says right now at an airport duty-free shop, you show a boarding pass for international travel, and when you purchase your items, you get them without duties or taxes.
In many cases, there can be substantial savings, particularly on items that even before the tariffs were introduced had existing tariffs on them that made them more expensive in the United States. And those are typically luxury items like imported wines, cosmetics, and tobacco.
Duty-free shopping isn't just for people who can afford expensive international flights. They're also available at land border crossings.
Americans who live near our border with Canada and Mexico can also benefit, because there are typically duty-free shops right around the border checkpoints with those countries as well.
So could duty-free shopping be an option for consumers trying to avoid import taxes?
No, not in a large way.
MIT professor Simon Johnson is a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund and joint winner of the 2024 Nobel Prize in Economics.
If you take a trip to Canada and the Canadians are willing to sell you something that's free of Canadian taxes at the border, then the issue is, how does U.S. Customs view what you're bringing back in the trunk of your car, or if you have a trailer or a truck?
Johnson doesn't expect significant crackdowns on small amounts of goods.
But it would really surprise me, and it would go counter to the spirit and the letter of what Mr. Trump is putting forward if they were to allow significant amounts of imports in that way.
U.S. travelers are allowed to return with $800 worth of goods or gifts duty-free, but Laird cautions...
You absolutely need to declare anything that you are bringing back into the country, because if you don't, it can have implications on your future international travel. It can result in longer waits at customs because, you know, customs can't trust you anymore.
You hear that? Don't even try to fill your car with duty-free chocolates, eh?
Ah, foiled again. This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, how can one man disrupt the global economy? We talk about Trump's tariffs, why they've led stock markets to plummet, how they're changing our relationship with allies and adversaries, and what tariffs mean for our daily lives. We talk with Zanny Minton Beddoes, editor-in-chief of The Economist. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Have you ever felt like you just couldn't please anyone? Well, that's what inspired Lola Young's hit, Messy. That song has topped charts all over the world after it went viral on TikTok last year. Who are you saying that to?
I think it was to myself in a weird roundabout way. Like, can I not just accept this person who I am, and can I not just let other people love me for what I am? And like, then also I was saying it to my ex, like.
To your ex, yeah. And to you, and maybe the world, right? Because sometimes the world wants you to be something
and yeah. You're not.
Lola Young stopped by our offices in Culver City. She's in Los Angeles to take one of the biggest stages of her career, Coachella, which starts this weekend. And Messy is sure to be the sing-along moment of her set. She says being diagnosed with ADHD helped her make sense of the song.
I got diagnosed after I wrote the song, and it just made a lot of sense for me, working out things mentally, understanding that, like, God, that's why I'm like that. And I'm too perfect, so I open my big mouth. I want to be me. Is that not allowed? And I'm too clever, and then I'm too stupid dumb. You hate it when I cry, unless it's that time of the month. And I'm too perfect, so I show you that I'm not a thousand people I could be for you, but hate the whole damn world.
Do you ever think, like, when you're creating music, when you're writing it, that, like, maybe this line would eventually sound great on TikTok?
I mean, no.
No? Yeah. It's, and if you ever thought that, would you feel like, hey, wait a second?
Yes, because I never try and think about the consumer or what's going to happen to the song. I just try and write from the heart. And as soon as I start thinking about the outside room, as it were, like, then it can massively mess you up and make you think, oh my God, like, what am I actually doing this for? Who am I doing it for?
What, 24 years old?
I'm 24, correct.
From London.
Yeah.
How did you get into just wanting to sing?
I always knew it was what I wanted to be, and I think I was never good at anything else, so I didn't have the kind of B option of like, oh, this is what I'd do if it didn't work out. So I just had to put my mind to it and go, I have to just keep working hard and keep honing in on my craft, and I feel like something good's going to happen. And I didn't know it would be at what scale or what that would come of it. I just had that constant like sense of, this is really what I want.
This is actually what most people figure out what they want to do. They realize what they're only good at. Right?
Exactly, yeah. We can pretend that
we're in love when you come home. Let's listen to another song, Wish You Were Dead. So Lola, this song gives me the vibe that you think there's a big difference between saying you love someone and actually liking that person.
Yes,
so
yes,
what's
yes,
the,
yes,
to
yes.
you, what's the difference?
I'm still figuring out, in all honesty, what I think love is. I think love changes as you get older and as you're in love more times. Like, it can take shape in different ways and you feel it in different ways. But in the relationships I've been in, I felt like I haven't really liked them, and I can claim I've been like in love with them. And even in that line, I say, like, you know, we can pretend that we're in love, because it's just like that feeling of lust and toxicity can sometimes overpower what is the premise of it.
And maybe not literally dead, but dead to you, like dead.
Yeah, dead to me. Oh yeah, yeah. I'm literally dead. I'm joking.
And literally dead.
No, no, of course, no, definitely not. So. No.
Now let's listen to one more song. This song is Intrusive Thoughts.
Hey there, intrusive thoughts, you don't make sense at all. Wish you would go away with some paracetamol. Hey there, intrusive thoughts, maybe I'm wired all strange. All these intrusive thoughts, don't know what's real or not. They scream inside my head, wish I could kill the Lord. I've got intrusive thoughts, maybe I'm wired all strange.
Now, you were diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder at 17, and you've only talked about mental issues. Do you, Lola, view that as something that someday, for lack of a better word, and I apologize ahead of time, something that you want to cure, or is that something that just makes you you?
I think it just makes me me. I think I've gone through the motions with my mental health, and I think I've spoken about it a lot publicly, and I think it's something that can be used in a powerful way, but I think it's a thing I've learned to live with. I think there's a lot to say about it, but I think I'll leave it just, you know, it being difficult and beautiful at the same time.
Kinda messed up that you are me. Guess we just play nicely.
Yeah, because I think one of the great things about artists today, that it seems like that is something that is not off limits anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's like an openness to artists talking about this, which I think helps people that listen to it and think, you know what, I don't have to just sit here in silence and suffer.
No, for sure. I think there's a stigma to be broken down. And I think that it's important just to be vocal about what you're experiencing, because if you're not vocal about what you're experiencing, you're sitting, like you're saying, you're suffering, and that's never okay.
Have you heard from people about, like, the way you've been open and some of the lyrics in your songs that, hey, this has helped me a little bit?
Yeah, and I think that's what, you know, that's partially why I do this, because it means that people feel like they have a voice, they're able to stand up and say what their experiences is, and everyone's different, but it's also just important to be vocal and speak up, you know?
Oh, hey there, intrusive thoughts, we got off on the wrong foot back there, come on in, I'll put the kettle on. They're just intrusive thoughts, and maybe I'm not all that strange.
That's Lola Young. Her album is titled This Wasn't Meant For You Anyway, and she'll be performing at the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival. Lola, thank you so much for stopping by.
No worries. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On the hit medical drama The Pitt, actress Taylor Dearden is being celebrated for her portrayal of a talented young emergency room doctor who, like Dearden, is neurodivergent.
Recognizing that something's hard for anyone and then being able to overcome it if you are neurodivergent, like, hopefully that should just make it even sweeter.
I'm Elsa Chang. How The Pitt portrays neurodivergence and gets it right. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Beijing is answering Washington's ultimatum on tariffs with an additional levy on U.S. imports. China's announcement today puts the overall tariff level on U.S. goods at 84%. The U.S.'s levies on China's goods hit 104% overnight. an escalating trade war between the two biggest economies on the planet. NPR's John Ruwitch says each side's holding firm.
President Trump says he's waiting for a call from China to do a deal. But Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Lin Jian said if the U.S. wants to negotiate, it should adopt an attitude of equality, mutual benefit, and respect. China, he said, will continue to take firm and strong measures to resolutely safeguard its legitimate rights and interests.
For its part, the European Union's imposing retaliatory tariffs on 22 billion euros worth of American products. The only member nation that opposed the plan was Hungary, whose Prime Minister Viktor Orban is a staunch Trump ally. Nebraska's blue dot survives. NPR's Josh Snyder explaining state lawmakers have turned back an attempt to bring Nebraska in line with most other winner-take-all states.
Two GOP lawmakers broke with the party despite a pressure campaign by Republican Governor Jim Pillen. The winner-take-all push heated up during the 2024 presidential campaign when there was speculation that the race could be decided by just one vote. Omaha's blue dot, 2nd Congressional District. Nebraska is one of only two states that split their electoral votes by congressional district.
This is NPR. Major League Baseball is mourning the deaths of former players Octavio Dotel, Tony Blanco, and others in Santo Domingo. Nelsy Cruz, the governor of the Dominican Republic's Monte Cristi province and the sister of MLB All-Star Nelson Cruz, was also killed. In a statement, MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred says the connection between baseball and the Dominican Republic runs deep. Local authorities say at least 113 people were killed and hundreds more injured when the roof of Santo Domingo's iconic Jet Set nightclub collapsed early yesterday. It's unknown what caused the roof to cave in. A search for victims continues this hour. Germany's mainstream center-right and center-left parties have a deal to form a new coalition government. Details from NPR's Rob Schmitz.
The agreement comes amid pressure on German politicians to quickly form a new government to head off historic challenges brought on by President Trump's trade war and an increasingly aggressive Russian president, Vladimir Putin. The agreement also comes a month and a half after conservative politician Friedrich Merz's Christian Democratic Union won a snap election in February, a record pace for German political parties, which typically take months to enter into coalition government. The deal between the conservatives and the Social Democratic Party clears the way for Merz to be sworn in as Germany's next chancellor within weeks. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
U.S. stocks higher this hour with the Dow up 57 points. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Ami Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faldin in Washington, D.C. Three children who don't have legal status in the U.S. are expected back in school this week in Sackett's Harbor, New York. The kids and their mom were detained during a raid last month on a dairy farm. As NPR's Brian Mann reports, the family was released following protests and a bipartisan lobbying effort.
This story begins in late March when public school teachers, including Jonna St. Croix, learned three of their students, two teenagers and a third grader, had been detained along with their mother during a late night raid.
I understood that there may be some students in my classroom that were vulnerable, but I certainly did not expect this to happen.
Government officials aren't releasing the names of the family for privacy reasons. St. Croix says the reaction in the Sackett's Harbor Public School after they were sent to a migrant detention facility in Texas was immediate.
During our planning periods and lunch periods, we just worked to figure out what we could do to get them back.
That effort quickly spread to much of the community of Sackett's Harbor, a conservative small town near the U.S.-Canada border that voted for President Donald Trump. For people like 19-year-old Berlin Urbina, the big national debate over immigration was suddenly real and personal.
I mean, it was shocking at first because I knew those kids. I had classes with them. I had played in gym class with the little boys, so it was devastating for everyone.
Bring our kids back!
Last weekend, Urbina marched with nearly 1,000 other people here, demanding the mom and her kids be sent home. Not everyone here agreed. Don Pitcher joined a small counter-protest and said migrants without legal status should be deported.
Bottom line is, you either got to be here on a work visa, have a green card, or come here legally. And when you don't, these are the consequences.
One twist in this case is that Trump administration border czar Tom Homan owns a vacation home in Sackett's Harbor. He wasn't here over the weekend, but protesters marched past his house.
Tom Homan took our kids!
In a statement, U.S. Customs and Border Protection officials said the raid that triggered this case actually began as part of a criminal investigation targeting a foreign national who allegedly possessed child pornography. Speaking with local television station 7 News, Homan suggested the family was being held as part of that investigation.
Can they provide information and evidence in this crime? Were they victimized?
Local officials dispute that account and said they feared the family would be deported out of the U.S. Efforts to bring them home grew to include local dairy farmers, a Republican state assemblyman, and Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, who told NPR this raid should never have happened.
The door is broken down. There are masked individuals with guns that go into a child's bedroom.
Hochul confirmed yesterday federal immigration police have released the mother and 3 children. Berlin Urbina says she's happy the pressure campaign seems to have worked.
It's amazing, I think, that everybody came together.
Jonathan Croy, who teaches social studies, says the debate over immigration and Trump's deportation policy is complex. But for her, this moment is simple.
I am so grateful, and just an empty desk really stands out, and I can't wait for them to be back in our classrooms. I'm so grateful for everyone who helped.
Local officials say this family was already attending court hearings aimed at gaining legal status. That process will now resume. Brian Mann, NPR News, Sackett's Harbor, New York.
President Trump has set out to drastically reshape the federal workforce. And yesterday, he got some help in the effort from the U.S. Supreme Court.
In a brief unsigned order, the court said the administration is free to move forward with the firing of 16,000 probationary federal employees. But the decision wasn't a total victory for the administration, since, for now at least, the court made no ruling on whether the firings themselves were actually legal.
NPR's Nina Totenberg has been following the case and joins us now to break it all down. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Layla.
Okay, so let's jump in here. This is only the latest case in which the Supreme Court has taken a so-called emergency action at the behest of the Trump administration. And lately, they're winning more than they're losing, right?
Yes. On Friday, the court allowed the Trump administration to cancel millions of dollars in education grants. Then 2 days ago, the court threw out a lower court action temporarily barring the deportation of alleged Venezuelan gang members, though there was a caveat that required all the deportees to have a hearing before a federal judge on their individual deportation orders. And yesterday, the court threw out a lower court order that barred the administration from firing 16,000 probationary employees. The court said that the plaintiffs in the case were not the employees themselves, but nonprofit groups who failed to show that they themselves would be hurt by the firings.
Okay, let's drill down on this latest one. What does probationary in this context mean?
It means the fired employee has to be on the job for a year or less, or in some cases more, time that includes people who are serving in a job that they were promoted to, for instance.
Okay, so the Trump administration asked the Supreme Court to get rid of that lower court order, and it did. So what happens now? Do these fired employees have any recourse left?
Yes, but it's going to take time, and therein lies the rub. The employees have to first challenge their firings at the Merit Systems Protection Board, which is the federal agency charged with protecting civil servants. And for the most part, the most efficient way to do that is systematically with a class action that says, essentially, we are representing all of these similarly situated fired employees, and we as a class should be reinstated. But in order to be certified as a class, they have to go before an administrative judge at the Merit Systems Protection Board. And so far, there have been more than 10,000 cases filed since October, including 20 class action suits. And I would presume that when the dust settles, there will be lots more class actions.
A lot of suits. Can the Merit System Protection Board actually act quickly?
The MSPB system is meant to be fast, with cases finalized in 120 days, and the judge's decisions become final in 35 days unless there's some intervening action by the Merit Systems Protection Board. Initially, any appeal would be taken by the MSPB board, but the agency didn't even have a quorum until 2 days ago, and the two board members there for the moment might well cancel each other's votes out. And in any event, the law allows a relatively quick appeal to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And in that setting, for sure, there will be thousands of employees who do have legal standing to sue and have been harmed.
NPR's Nina Totenberg. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
For decades, the religion of Silicon Valley was technology, but Christians there are becoming more vocal about their faith, and it's catching on. That's next time in Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. Have you ever taken an Uber and then left something in the car? Well, you're not the only one. And chances are you didn't leave the weirdest thing behind either. Uber released its annual Lost and Found Index showing all the items passengers have forgotten, like a urinal and 10 live lobsters. The most common items forgotten were phones, keys, and wallets. The lesson here is check before you exit and maybe leave the urinal at home. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Parents planning to send their kids to college may have a lot of questions right now since the Trump administration gutted the agency that administers federal student loans. It says the Small Business Administration may take over management of nearly $2 trillion in loans. At the same time, President Trump's tariff plan has shaken markets, shrinking the value of 529 college savings plans. So what do all those changes mean for college-bound students?
It's a nightmare, honestly.
That's Stuart Siegel. He's a longtime financial aid advisor who owns College Tuition Solutions Incorporated. I asked him how he's advising parents and students during uncertain times.
I'm not so concerned about the parents who are looking for student loans right now. They're going to be able to get them. It's the people who are in repayment or about to go into repayment. You know, we have students graduating, parents who have PLUS loans, the parent loans, undergraduate students. They're very concerned. And at this point, yes, it is awful for somebody with almost 30 years of experience in this to be able to say, I just don't know how this is going to play out.
So for a parent that has a kid who plans to enroll in college in a year or so, are you saying that they should be okay, or should they be doing anything different now than before?
Well, if you have a student going to college in a couple of years, there's a number of things you have to do regarding student loans or parent loans. That's something that they should discuss with their financial planners in terms of having a plan to repay their loans. So what I try to do is have parents do a couple of things, and that is have a money talk with their students. This is probably the most productive thing families can do, is discuss what the parents can do financially. And if the student understands that, when they go into their college search, they have to look at the financial aid part of it, and they are much more likely to take price into consideration. This is a great way to manage expectations.
Now, do you think that savings plans like a 529 are still a safe bet? I mean, I know you specialize in federal student aid, but when it comes to saving for college, I mean, what kind of security does a parent have on that?
Right now, if I was a parent starting a plan, for example, I think I'd be putting my money into cash equivalents, CDs, money markets, that sort of thing. If you are finding yourself with a diminished 529 at the moment, you have to look at some of the alternatives, including if you own your own home, you can always take out a home equity or a line of credit, or you can go to a bank and take out a loan, or even a parent loan to undergraduate students. The PLUS loan program, which many parents are aware of, if they utilize that for a while until their assets recover, that's certainly an option for them.
Do you have a single message that you have for parents that might be panicking when they see the world's finances look the way they look right now?
The best advice I can give people, if they're saving for college or they're looking towards college in this couple of years, is just do the best you can today. You can't look too far in the future because you just don't know.
All right, Stuart Siegel is the owner of College Tuition Solutions Incorporated. He advises parents on how to navigate college financing. Stuart, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
An American classic, The Great Gatsby, turns 100 years old tomorrow. Later today on All Things Considered, a look at how its narrative about class differences being taught in schools today. This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. If you've dabbled in dating apps, you probably know how cutthroat online dating can feel. But the hit YouTube series Pop the Balloon or Find Love takes it to a whole new level.
Do you want children?
Yes.
I'm not having no babies.
I know. I know.
On the show, someone looking for love appears before a panel of other singles, all holding a red balloon. If panelists see or hear anything they don't like, they pop their balloon. It can get a little vicious, but some contestants have found love, and this Thursday, a live version of Pop the Balloon comes to Netflix. I spoke with the married couple who created the show, Arlette Amoli, and her husband, Bolia Matundu, who goes by BM. So, BM, what made you think this is gold? I can make something out of this.
Because I like the idea of the whole people standing in a line. It's kind of like speed dating, where you can basically pick somebody fast and pop a balloon if you don't like them. And I thought, you know, this is actually a good idea. And I felt like there's probably two things that people most speak about in this world, which is one, relationships, and two, sports. So I was like, okay, let me see what I can do here.
You know, it's 2025, and online dating is just kind of a normal thing now. People are swiping on their phones, figuring out how and who to date online. How does this show compare to online dating, would you say?
Yeah, what differs it from online dating is these thoughts that you would have in your head when you're online dating, you're now kind of like forced to say it to the person instead of just swiping left or swiping right.
And when people are in that situation, I mean, how do you feel like they handle these types of situations? It's not easy sometimes to just kind of look someone eye to eye and explain to them why you don't like them or aren't interested in them.
Exactly. Yeah, it gives you a glimpse of the person's character. Some people, you know, they can answer a difficult question with a little bit more decorum, whereas others will just be completely blunt and just tell you the honest truth. So it just lets you see, oh, okay, yeah, this person's not for me based off of how they respond to specific questions.
Yeah, and sometimes that blunt, honest truth can venture into mean territory. Let's hear a clip, because there have been criticisms of the show that it thrives on these viral, mean moments where participants say some pretty nasty things about each other. Let's listen to one exchange here.
How did you end up popping your balloon for Brian?
Hey, Brian, I love the way you speak, but for me, it was the pants. I don't like the pants too tight. I'm kind of ghetto, too, so I like them a little loose, and that was just it for me.
How old are you?
34.
You're 34?
Mm-hmm. But it's just me. I'm a single parent. Okay. There's no men in my life.
Okay. Why is the reason for there no man in your life?
Well, my first child, his father passed away, and the other two are nowhere to be found.
They do you like that? What's wrong with them?
Only God knows.
Or is there something wrong with you?
Possibly, but I think I'm just fine.
All right, so that's one exchange. I mean, other times contestants have been accused of colorism and body shaming. I mean, how do you respond, Arlette, to the criticism that your show maybe trades in mean kind of superficial discourse?
I think every now and then we do have those small little moments where someone is just a little bit more brutally honest than what people are used to, and that's what happens to go viral. We just tell our contestants, you know, you don't know these people. Take what they're saying with a grain of salt. A lot of the times, the people on the stage or on the show, they're not even offended. A lot of them actually become friends after the show.
Now, the show isn't all about rejection. So let's hear a love match. This is Ashley, the contestant who popped her balloon after a potential match said he wanted kids. Let's hear that one.
So I just have one final question. So, Ashley, is it going to be a yes for you?
Yeah.
He's going to take me off the mat. Bye, y'all.
And is it a yes for you?
Yes.
Oh, my God, we got our first match!
Yeah. So there we go, Arlette. You sound just as happy as the contestants when they make a match. How many people do you think have actually wound up dating long-term-ish after meeting on your show? I know the show is not very old yet, but, I mean, how many people do you think are still dating that have decided to match?
Oh, man. Oh, gosh, that's a hard question.
We have about 8. We have about 8 to 10.
Oh, 8, babe?
Yeah.
Why do you think people sign themselves up for this? Why would someone put themselves through this?
Because some people need help. They need something new, something different. So a lot of people want to try it out and see. And some people as well, they're seeing results. You know, they're seeing results. So they're like, you know what? This person found love. Let me go and try it. It might work for me.
And I guess if they wind up being together for the rest of their lives, they have a funny story to tell how they met, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Arlette Amuli and Bolia Matundo are the creators of Pop the Balloon or Find Love. It comes to Netflix tomorrow.
A singer who first hit the Billboard charts in the 1950s has done it again at the age of 90. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music reports.
Over love letters in the sun.
Pat Boone used to be a staple of the Billboard charts. The straight-laced crooner sold tens of millions of records en route to a prolific career. Much of his early chart success came from his status as a wholesome counterpart to Elvis Presley, and from a lucrative willingness to re-record R&B songs by black artists. Just to be clear, that is not Little Richard, it's Pat Boone's 1957 cover of Tutti Frutti. When Billboard's Adult Contemporary chart was introduced in July of 1961, Pat Boone was on it. Now, for the first time in nearly half a century, he's back on that chart with the song One, Voices for Tanzania, which is credited to Pat Boone World Missions.
One, I am one, like no other human being, I am one.
As its title suggests, the song is a benefit for infrastructure projects in Tanzania, clean water initiatives in particular, and features an assortment of country and gospel singers, including Lee Greenwood, Vince Gill, and Larry Gatlin. Before this week, Pat Boone hadn't been seen on a Billboard chart since 2007, when his album We Are Family, R&B Classics, made a brief appearance on the top R&B and hip-hop albums chart. Who's to say Pat Boone and hip-hop don't go hand in hand?
Okay, listen up, everybody. We are family.
This week, Pat Boone set a new record for the longest span between songs on the Adult Contemporary chart, 63 years, 8 months, and 3 weeks. And he's got a decent shot at returning someday. After all, if Perry Como and Paul Anka can revisit the pop charts every holiday season, why couldn't Pat Boone? Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez.